Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Historical Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Dermot Mulready about his biography of the Irish political leader John Redmond. In many ways, Redmond today is the forgotten man of Irish history, but a century ago, he was the leader of the Irish Nationalist Party, the dominant political party in Irish politics. In 1914, he was on the verge of achieving the goal of home rule within the United Kingdom, a goal that had been long sought by Irish activists before the outbreak of the First World War transformed British politics, leaving Redmond to be eclipsed by events. Dermot, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark.
Dermot, I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Okay, well, I've been a teacher, a high school teacher most of my career, which went for about 35 years. But during that time, I was teaching mathematics and science mainly, but I'd always had an interest in history. In mid-career, I did a degree with London University in history. And when I finished that, I was looking around for a project to work on, a historical project. I found there was a large gap in the biographical record when it came to this particular man, John Redmond. The last previous full-length biography of Redmond had been published in 1932. So I was there in the late 90s looking around for a suitable topic, and it just seemed to me, I mean, I'd always had a fascination with the period around the turn of the 20th century in Irish nationalist politics, and at that combined with the long gap in the biographical record regarding Redmond decided me to try this. So I spent about 12 years altogether researching and writing the two volumes of the biography, which we're now talking about.
And the first volume came out in, 2008?
2008, exactly.
And that took Redmond's life up to 1900. And I was wondering if you could just spend a minute talking about his early years. Just give us a bit of background to where that brings us to where the second volume begins.
Okay, well, Redmond began as a very young politician. He became an MP in the Westminster Parliament at the age of 24. He joined the Irish Home Rule Party, the Irish Parliamentary Party, at exactly the moment when the charismatic Charles Stewart Parnell had just taken over the leadership and was fashioning the party into a disciplined parliamentary instrument for the achievement of Irish autonomy or Irish self-government. So Redmond became a junior member of the party. His own background had been he descended from an old Catholic landed Anglo-Norman family, which had been dispossessed in the wars of the 17th century. They had been dispossessed but not expelled, so they stayed around and became quite prosperous in farming and so on. And when Catholic emancipation came in 1829, his ancestors did quite well. They joined the kind of county lieutenancy and so on under British rule. We're talking about the county which is the most southeasterly on the island of Ireland, County Wexford. His family, Redmond's immediate ancestors, were involved in the public life of County Wexford. So he inherited a tradition of public service in that county. And in fact, his father was one of the first Home Rule MPs to be elected in 1872 when the Home Rule Party was founded. So Redmond became an apprentice, you might say, to his father. He attended university for a couple of years but didn't graduate. Instead, he went to London and sat in the House of Commons watching his father and the other MPs of the Irish Parliamentary Party as they campaigned for Home Rule and so on. So he became a very young MP, and at the he joined at the, as I said, under Parnell's leadership. What was happening in Ireland at that time was a very great ferment. The Land League, which was the agrarian organisation, which was aimed at improving the lot of the Irish tenants under the landlord system and ultimately winning a winning ownership of the land for the tenants. That Land League was at the height of its activity in 1881 when Redmond joined, became a politician. And so Redmond joined at the very moment when a lot of things were happening, a lot of ferment in Parliament and outside Parliament, including a lot of agrarian violence in all over the countryside in Ireland. A little later, when things quietened down a bit in 1883, Parnell sent him on a 1 year a mission to Australia and New Zealand. And so he spent a full year there traveling, canvassing support for the for constitutional methods for the party at home, and also fundraising among Irish emigrants in those countries. On his way home, he actually didn't come back directly. He came via the United States, and he made the first of total of 9 visits in his life to the United States. He came back from Australia via San Francisco, crossed the continent, and met up with prominent Irish American politicians, mainly based in New York and Boston. At that time, the Irish American political elite, if you like, were very much conspiratorial. They didn't hold with the constitutional methods of agitation, but they were rather wedded. Many of them had been former revolutionaries in Ireland who had been exiled or otherwise emigrated to the States from Ireland. So Redmond had had quite a job selling the idea of peaceful constitutional campaigning for home rule to these guys. He was quite feisty, and he was helped by the fact that he was an extremely good orator in Parliament. So these helped him. He made another trip to the States for the Chicago Convention of the support group for the Home Rule Party. That was in 1886. So these were young experiences, youthful experiences that stayed with him for the rest of his life. He, in Australia and New Zealand, he came across Irish emigrants who were actually prospering under a form of British rule, if you like, an autonomous form, but yet under the British Constitution. In America, he met the other side of the Irish diaspora, the Irish who were very embittered, if you like, against Britain and wanted a violent break with British rule. So he saw both sides of the Irish diaspora on that trip at the age of 27 in 1880.
So his commitment to home rule was not simply a sense of this is the best we'll be able to do. It was a positive commitment. He believed in the idea of Ireland remaining part of the British system, if you will, albeit one with greater autonomy and freedom.
Yes, this marked him out from many of his contemporaries. Many of his colleagues in the Irish Parliamentary Party did have this sort of stance that you just described. There were people who felt, well, we'd like to win greater autonomy, but this is the best we can that we can achieve. He himself developed a positive attachment to the idea of autonomy within the British Empire from his experiences of meeting the Irish diaspora in Australia and New Zealand. So that is true.
And of course, 1886 was a very important year in terms of the home rule issue.
Well, it was.
Go ahead.
Because that was the year when, well, in early that year, due to Parnell's use or exploitation, if you like, of the position, the balance of power position, which the Home Rule Party held in the British Parliament. Prime Minister Gladstone was persuaded to introduce a Home Rule Bill for Ireland. It didn't succeed. It got as far as a second reading in the House of Commons, but the Gladstone's own Liberal Party split on the issue, and so Gladstone was forced to withdraw the bill. It didn't deter the young members of the Irish Home Rule Party, they had found the whole events had moved with such speed over the preceding year that they were exhilarated by the pace of events. And when the bill went down and was withdrawn, they took the attitude that, well, we've actually got further than we had ever expected to go in such a short time. And they reckoned that another attempt would be made very, very quickly. So they were quite hopeful after the debacle in the House of Commons. Now, as things turned out, a second Home Rule Bill was not introduced until 1893, so 7 years later, although still by Gladstone, who was by then a very, very old man. He was in his last year in politics. A second Home Rule Bill, that second Home Rule Bill went further than the first. It actually got voted through the House of Commons by a majority, but as everybody expected, the House of Lords slapped a veto on it, and so the bill failed.
And by that point, Parnell had died. The Irish Parliamentary Party had, in effect, split over this issue of his relationship with Kitty O'Shea and the revelation of the divorce and everything. So where does Redmond fit in terms of the split and the aftermath of Parnell's demise?
Well, in the split itself, which was very traumatic for the Irish Party, which began in late 1890, the majority of the party took the attitude that Parnell couldn't remain as leader because Gladstone had said that that he himself, as leader of the Liberal Party, couldn't remain as in alliance with the Irish Parliamentary Party if Parnell remained as leader. So the majority of the Irish Party then abandoned Parnell as leader. Redmond was the most prominent of the MPs who remained loyal to Parnell. So the party split along the lines of about 2-1. About 28 MPs stayed loyal to Parnell, and Redmond effectively became their leader. He hadn't been previously in the front rank of the party because after he came back from Australia, he'd adopted a slightly less prominent position. But when the split happened, the split kind of catapulted him to a leadership post within those who remained loyal to Parnell. Roughly double that number of MPs abandoned Parnell. So for the rest of that decade, for the whole of the 1890s, Redmond led what was really seen then as a rump of the original Irish parliamentary party. The Parnellites typically won about one third of the nationalist vote in Ireland, but because of the British system of election, which is not proportional but first past the post, Redmond's band of MPs only won 9 seats in the parliament as opposed to over 70 seats won by the anti-Parnellite opposition. So that this split within Irish nationalism, within parliamentary nationalism, remained until 1900. It was very bitter, but it remained strictly at the verbal level. It never descended into violence. It went through many twists and turns, which are too convoluted to go into here. But by 1900, Redmond was seen as the of the prominent leaders on both sides. Redmond was seen as the one who was most likely to conciliate the people on the opposite side, and so he was elected leader in early in the year in 1900.
Was that a function of his rhetorical skills? Was that a sense that he had done a better job leading the Parnellite faction in the 1890s? What exactly made him stand out from a lot of other very prominent individuals?
What made him stand out? Well, you mentioned his rhetorical skills, and that was certainly a factor. He was seen as a very good parliamentary performer, not simply rhetorical skills, but knowledge of parliamentary procedure. He was seen as a consummate parliamentary man. But on top of that, he was also somebody who, during the very bitter verbal conflicts of the 1890s, he had stayed, he had managed to keep his rhetoric free from personal rancor, whereas some of the other, well, one in particular on the other side, Tim Healy, was somebody who could never have been seen as a conciliator. He was, his rhetoric had been very, I mean, right from the beginning, right from the start of the Parnell divorce case, he had been he had a very scurrilous form of rhetoric and of debunking the opposition. Redmond's rhetoric remained free of that, so he was seen as personally affable and as somebody who could conciliate. And these expectations were fulfilled when, within a couple of years, within two or three years of him becoming leader, MPs on both sides, formerly on both sides, were saying that Redmond had been a great conciliator, that he had managed to heal the wounds of the split. So this certainly was one of the things that stood to his credit.
And then, but when he takes over the now reunited parliamentary party in 1900, the prospects don't seem to be good in the short term. The unionists have a majority in the parliament. And yet, one of the things that really stands out in those first chapters describing the period between, say, 1900 and you know, 1905, 1906, is how much he's able to accomplish for Ireland, not so much in terms of home rule, but in terms of a lot of other issues that matter greatly to Ireland.
Sure. When at the time he became leader in 1900, Ireland was midway through 10 years of Tory rule. And the Tory policy by 1900 has been summed up as killing home rule with kindness. In other words, they were intent on defusing the popular Irish desire for home rule by enacting measures which they supposed would conciliate Irish nationalists. So, for example, in 1898 they brought in democratic local government, which was a very, very significant move. But by 1900, the big item on the agenda, Redmond realized that the Tories were going to be in power for quite a while. So he knew that home rule wasn't going to be a practical issue. But the one issue that was was worth taking seriously was the land question. Ever since the start of his career 20 years earlier, the big demand major demand of Irish nationalist politicians at Westminster after self-government itself was a resolution of the land question. And this meant, in practical terms, it meant the government financing the peasants or the tenant farmers to enable them to purchase their holdings from the landlords. The landlords owned vast tracts of land which were parceled out to, in some cases, hundreds, or in extreme cases, thousands of tenants. So the scheme that everybody knew would needed to be enacted was a scheme which would advance loans to the tenants. Those loans would then be used to buy out the landlords, and the tenants would pay back the loans at repayment rates which were lower than the historical rent rates which they had paid to the landlords. So this was the nuts and bolts of the scheme. So Redmond's agitation for the first 3 years of his leadership, or the first 2 years of his leadership, was aimed at getting the Tory government to enact this scheme. He was lucky that it was a prosperous time. The economy was doing well in Britain. The Treasury was willing to do this. And he was also lucky in the fact that the chief secretary, in other words, Britain's chief representative in Ireland, was emotionally and personally favourable to Irish aspirations. So Chief Secretary Wyndham persuaded the Treasury to give out a very large sum of money, which would which was then parceled out to the tenants. So in 3 years, Redmond achieved the greatest of the land acts, the land purchase acts. There had been other previous acts in the 1890s, but the finance had been too meager. This was the big one. And it's extremely significant in Ireland's history, because what it means, you know, if you compare with other countries in Eastern Europe at the time when which had agrarian problems, Poland and Russia, when the revolution happened in Russia, there was a major the land question in the peasantry was a major component of the revolution. In Ireland, by the time the violent revolution for independence came in 1916, the social component had already been solved peacefully. The land question was resolved largely without the shedding of a drop of blood. By 1916, 62% of Irish land had been, the ownership of, had been transferred to the people who worked the land. So therefore, there was little or no, there was a small residual element, of course, but there, the social, the agrarian element in the Irish Revolution had basically been resolved.
Nothing on the scale of, say, the 1870s with the boycott campaign and so forth.
Well, the boycott campaign had been an early tactic or engine of the early struggles, but that had Gladstone in 1881 had brought in a reforming Land Act, which also merits the title of great, because it did bring in, effectively, it brought in joint ownership between the tenants and the landlords. It didn't have a purchase component in it. So legally, landlords remained as the owners and tenants remained as the rent payers. But that 1881 Land Act of Gladstone had set up land courts, which every 15 years reviewed rents. And when they reviewed them, they always recast them in a downward direction. So effectively, from 1881, the landlords were losing in terms of rent. The real value of rents was decreasing. And this gave a very large incentive for the landlords. Then when the Wyndham Act of 1903 came, it gave the landlords a strong incentive to go for selling the land to the tenants. Their situation was not improving as it was under the rent paying system. So that's the nub of the land question had been resolved effectively. The setting in train of the resolution might be more accurate in 1903, and for the rest of that decade and well up to into the life of the independent Irish state in the 1920s, the rest of the process of sale and purchase was still going on, you know, to bring the final 20-30% of Irish land into farmer ownership.
So, yet in spite of this achievement, Redmond never really loses sight of his ultimate goal, which is home rule. And he is ultimately banking on a liberal victory in a general election. And that happens in 1906, and yet it happens in a way that actually frustrates his goal. And I was wondering if you could explain what happened there and what he does in the years immediately following 1906.
Well, in 1906, what happened was that the Liberals won a landslide against the Tories. So that meant that the Irish Party had became pretty irrelevant in the House of Commons. It didn't have any leverage it wasn't a case of the Liberal Party having ceased to believe in home rule. The Liberals still had home rule in their party program. The problem was that it wasn't near the top of their practical agenda. They had a very comprehensive program of liberal social reform within Great Britain, and giving Ireland home rule was pretty low on their list of priorities. So without leverage in the British Parliament, Redden couldn't do very much in the first few years. So he did campaign as much as he could, and he lobbied incessantly. The result was that in 1907, which was just the second year of the Liberal government, he won a devolution measure, which was turned out to be a poison chalice. It was presented to him as home rule by installment, and he saw the merit of that because he would never turn down an advance of any kind. But home rule by installment turned out the scale of the installment simply turned out to be too little, and he was damaged politically for a time. In going along with this, it didn't exactly cause a new split in the Irish Party, but it demoralized the party for a while, and it took most of the year of 1908 to restore the morale of the party. Luckily, the Liberals were also amenable to other reform legislation, and in fact 1908 turned out to be a very successful year for Redmond and the Irish Party in terms of other reforms. For example, a long-standing demand of Catholic Ireland, which effectively means nationalist Ireland. Catholic Ireland had long wanted a university of its own, or a university which was more in tune with the ethos of Catholics. Trinity College in Dublin was the main university in Ireland and had been there since Queen Elizabeth the first time, but it was seen as a bastion of Protestant and Anglo-Irish rule. So Redmond had joined the campaign for a university. It would be wrong to call it a Catholic university. It wasn't meant to be a confessional or sectarian university, but simply a university which Catholics could feel more comfortable in attending. In 1908, after a long period of lobbying, he actually won this university, and it became a reality the following year. He also won legislation for the Liberals to restore the evicted tenants, the tenants who had been out of their holdings in some cases for up to 20 years. As a result, they were known as the wounded soldiers of the land war having taken place in the 1880s, and some of these people the legislation that Redmond won in 1908 restored most of these to their original holdings or gave them alternative land holdings. So these were some of the reform victories that Redmond won. So the devolution fiasco of 1907 was happily for him soon forgotten. Then what really turned the tide in the fortunes of his party was something that happened within British politics, and this was a watershed in Redmond's career. In 1908, the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, Lloyd George, wanted to bring in a raft of new socially progressive legislation, including pensions for old age, for elderly people, and social insurance for workers. So these were two welfare measures which Lloyd George introduced in his budget of 1909.
Ones to be paid for with very high taxes on wealthy landowners, and also a tax that would impact many people in Ireland negatively, a tax on spirits.
Exactly, yeah. So Redmond, these conservative forces, if you like, are property owners who stood to lose from heavy taxation. They opposed the welfare program suggested by Lloyd George. But the people who actually turned it into a political crisis were the House of Lords, the upper house in Westminster. They vetoed the bill, the budget. They vetoed Lloyd George's budget in 1909. This put the government, the Liberal government, on a collision course with the upper house. And many of the prominent Liberals of the time, including Winston Churchill and Herbert Asquith, they saw the way things were heading. The government was going to have to face down the House of Lords. So Redmond, as a consummate parliamentary man, he saw the opportunity for the Irish Party here. He pledged support for the government facing down the House of Lords veto. If the House of Lords, pledged the support of the Irish Party to the government's campaign to face down the House of Lords veto in return for the Liberal Party agreeing to place Home Rule at the top of their practical agenda. So this then set the political agenda for the year 1910-1911. Now, even though in doing so, Redmond could not avoid antagonizing powerful conservative forces at home in Ireland, people who criticized the higher taxation being enacted by the Liberals.
But he saw an opportunity and he seized it, and this brought Ireland, or the Irish Parliamentary Party, to the to achieving something that O'Connell had never been able to achieve, that Parnell had never been able to achieve. And after the events of 1910, two general elections, the Liberals are only able to maintain office because they have the votes of the Irish parliamentarians.
Exactly.
So, yet in spite of all the success that he's having in Westminster, there are some portents or some sort of seeds of what's to come that are being sown in Ireland itself. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit to what he's doing how, in spite of his successes in Westminster, what's happening to the Irish Nationalist Party in Ireland itself, the gap that's emerging in particular between the generations?
Sure. Well, in the first decade of his leadership, even though these very significant reforms were won, which really transformed the face of Ireland, the revolution in land ownership, the university, various other reforms, housing for rural labourers and so on. While these reforms were transforming the face of Ireland, there was a blind spot which Redmond and the Irish Party didn't address, and this was the generation gap which was developing. Because this really goes back to the death of Parnell. The poet Yeats put this into verse, the fact that the death of Parnell, there was a certain loss of idealism among young nationalists, and in fact they had become embittered, or they had become disillusioned with politics per se in the 1890s, and this disillusionment persisted into the first decade of the Redmond's leadership of the Reunited Irish Party, so that many talented young people didn't really regard the Irish Party as terribly relevant, and they were putting their energies into other projects, such as the revival of the Gaelic language, into drama, the arts, and so on. Now, these people would form the intelligentsia of the future self-governing Ireland, but they were disenchanted with politics, and many of them, if Redmond had, and his colleagues, if they had taken a more proactive approach in the first decade of the 20th century, it's quite possible, we'll never know for sure, but it's quite possible that they could have enlisted many more of these talented younger people into the party and recruited them for the Home Rule cause. Now, they did it to a certain extent. There are some names like Tom Kettle, and people like that, Francis Cruz O'Brien, who stand out, but they didn't do enough of that, and they it wasn't so much that they alienated young people, but they certainly didn't do enough to address the disenchantment of young people with nationalist politics. So a lot of these younger folk then kind of came to maturity, viewing the Irish Party as a bunch of kind of aging, comfortable bourgeois people who are happy to sit in Parliament and at Westminster and just talk. And they it led to them the young generations underestimating the achievements of the Irish Party. So it's one of the mistakes that that can be put to the account of Redmond and his colleagues.
And it's a mistake that need not necessarily have been fatal, because in 1910, 1911, to bring us back to where we were there, it seems that he's about to achieve this goal. And so after 1911, you have a liberal government that is in office that is delivering on this promise. And this is where you really go into considerable depth regarding the negotiations. I was wondering if you could explain a bit what was happening there and why these negotiations were seen as necessary.
You're talking about the negotiations of the Home Rule Bill itself?
Yes, and the great dissent that you were seeing within Ulster about the issue and the growing radicalization of Home Rule as a political issue.
Well, of course, this we're talking now about the Achilles heel of the entire Irish nationalist project, including the Irish Home Rule movement. The Achilles heel being the fact that in the northeast corner of the island, there were 1 million people with a different shared history, a different ethnicity, a different religion, a different culture. The Ulster Protestants, what you in the United States would call the Scots-Irish, very much. There had been a brief meeting point at the end of the 18th century with the leaders of the Irish Catholic community, but all through the 19th century, the two communities had diverged. The Ulster Protestants had become prosperous. They had been part of the greater British Industrial Revolution. They had been in free trade with the mainland of Britain. And so their politics were unionist. They had no sympathy with separatist projects or any self-government projects for Ireland. And this was this put them at direct loggerheads with the Catholic nationalist community. The Catholic nationalists felt aggrieved because Britain had been slow to enact Catholic emancipation after the Union of 1800. That gave grounds then for nationalist agitation, and that was a mistake that the British government needn't have made, but unfortunately they did. So by the late 19th century, the two communities were facing in different directions, diametrically opposed. So when the first Home Rule Bill had been introduced in Parliament by Gladstone, there had been, well, at the time it collapsed, there had been rioting in Belfast, which was the capital of the northeast of Ireland. The unionists had rioted over the prospect that they might be subjected to majority rule coming from Dublin, from a Catholic-dominated Dublin Parliament. That was anathema to Ulster Protestants. Okay, so
not just anathema, but unprecedented, because in the 18th century, when Ireland did have a parliament, it was a parliament that was, by virtue of denying Catholics the vote, yeah, it was dominated by Protestants. So they were talking about the restoration of a Catholic rule that really had not been seen since the 16th century. And in their minds, that was something that was just totally unacceptable.
Exactly. Totally unacceptable. So by 1911, the House of Lords veto had been finally put to rest, had been removed. And so Home Rule was a third Home Rule Bill was now a serious political possibility or probability. And the Liberals were about to bring one in. They did introduce it. Prime Minister Asquith introduced it in April 1912. But for the entire year of 1911, Ulster Unionists was signalling to the British that it was simply not acceptable that they would be put under the rule of a Dublin Home Rule Parliament.
We should explain here that the the House Lords veto hadn't been eliminated, but it had been changed to where instead of it being an absolute veto, it was a 3-year suspensory veto. So home rule was not imminent in 1912. It was, or 1911. It was 3 years off. They had to go through this procedure of passing the bill and then passing it in two more sessions before it would become law. So now we're talking about a 3-year period in which Irish home rule is looming.
That's absolutely accurate, Mark. Yeah, they were looking at a historical inevitability. They could see home rule being enacted, put into effect 3 years down the road. And so they began, not only did they lobby politically at Westminster and agitate on political platforms across Britain and Ireland, but they also began preparations for military resistance if, in their eyes, the worst came to the worst. They began to recruit retired officers of the British Army to train local volunteers in resisting the imposition of Home Rule. Now, in 1912, the third Home Rule Bill was introduced in Parliament, and this was regarded by Nationalist Ireland as a moment of victory. Naturally, they could see things were set on course. As you said, a 3-year procedure of the bill had to pass through Parliament 3 times in 3 consecutive sessions, and by then it would be law. Of course, in 1912, nobody foresaw the Great War, although there were war clouds rumbling in Europe. Redmond and the rest of the of his Home Rule colleagues were sanguine. They were extremely sanguine that Ireland at last had reached the promised land. These biblical terms were used, the promised land and so on. At the same time, Ulster was becoming louder and louder in its threats to resist. Now, in 1912, the form that this resistance took was that both sides were playing the game for the full island. The home rulers wanted home rule for all of Ireland. That meant all 32 counties of Ireland. The Ulster opposition were campaigning to have home rule simply scrapped. They wanted no home rule for any part of Ireland. So this was obvious. This was a case of the irresistible force and the immovable object. When the bill was reintroduced in 1913 under the rules, I should say that in 1912, the majority of the actual debating, the majority of words spoken in Parliament, took place in 1912. In 1913, the bill was simply run through as a formality through the various stages. But by the fall of 1913, it had gone through the second of the 3 stages. So responsible politicians in Westminster on both sides were looking down at the following year, 1914. They were now, right up against the end of the process. They were seeing, right, by early next year, the bill is going to be pass all stages. It's going to become law, but we are facing into the possibility of serious civil conflict, violence on the island of Ireland. And we have, what can we do to avert this? And so out of the mists of the debates of late 1913, a lot of backroom discussions began to happen. People on both sides meeting senior figures in the British government, and out of this, the first intimations of a partition settlement began to emerge. And this, in the spring of 1914, then Prime Minister Asquith put the first partition scheme to Parliament, the first offer of excluding some of the counties in the northeast of Ireland from the Home Rule Bill, so that when it passed into law, it would be it would become law for the parts of Ireland which were a majority Catholic, majority nationalist, but it would, the other parts, the parts of Ulster which were majority Protestant Unionists would be excluded from the bill's from the bill's provisions.
So this was, now, yeah. Where is Redmond in this process, and what is his position on partition, and is that affecting his stance, his standing back in Ireland?
Okay, well, in 1914, in March 1914, when Prime Minister Asquith put the partition scheme, he put it in the form of, there were two main elements to it. First of all, it was to be temporary, only for 6 years. And secondly, it was to involve individual counties holding plebiscites and each county being able to decide to stay in or exclude itself from home rule. So Redmond very reluctantly agreed to support this, mainly on the grounds of it being temporary. There were other provisions of the bill which weren't going to kick in for a number of years in any case. So he could just about live with the idea of temporary exclusion of Ulster counties. But he had given hostages to fortune in his own speech-making the previous years. He had called, as recently as October 1913, he had called any proposal to partition Ireland as the mutilation of the Irish nation. And this was something that resonated that with his followers. Most Irish nationalists would have agreed with him on that, that they couldn't conceive. To them, the Irish nation meant the island of Ireland, all of it. Redmond and his parties, Redmond and his and all his fellow home rulers can be held culpable of failing to educate their followers to the reality that in the northeast of the island, there were 1 million people, up to roughly 22% of the island's population who would simply not accept home rule and were of a completely different tradition. But in 1914, Redmond agreed to the temporary partition scheme. Of course, Edward Carson, the leader of the Ulster Unionists, ironically born in Dublin and ironically an anti-partitionist, but forced into a partitionist stance, he rejected the offer of temporary partition. He said, giving us exclusion for 6 years is like a sentence of death with a stay of execution for 6 years. It's not acceptable. So from that point on, from March 1914, right up to the summer, there was deadlock in Parliament. And the deadlock in Parliament was reflected on the streets because the Ulster Volunteers had now come into being. This was a force of over 100,000 young, mainly young Protestant Unionist men who had run weapons into the province and were in a quite a powerful position. They were well trained, and over that period of months they had gathered fairly modern weaponry, so they were ready to fight. The people whom they would have been fighting were of two kinds. If the British government had attempted to enforce home rule for the whole island, the Ulster Volunteers would have found themselves facing British troops in military combat. But also by then, there was a nationalist volunteer force had come into being in late 1913. These were the Irish National Volunteers. They were bigger in number than the Ulster, but not as well trained, and their weaponry wasn't as good. But there would certainly, in the parts, in the northern parts of Ireland where the two communities were in close proximity, these two sets of volunteers would certainly have been in conflict. And it looked, by the summer of 1914, it certainly looked as if those two sets of volunteers were heading for a local civil war.
And it was one in which the British would have had problems with addressing, not only in terms of the conflict between the two sides, but there was also some questions about the ability to commit the British Army. And here I'm thinking of the Curragh Mutiny.
Sure. Yeah. In March 1914, a group of British officers who were stationed at the Curragh is in the Midlands of Ireland, and it was one of the one of a series of British Army bases or forts located in Nationalist Ireland. But the officer class of the Army was very often sympathetic to the Unionist cause. The rank and file of the Army tended to be Catholic, but the officer class tended to be Protestant and Unionist in its politics. At the Curragh in March 1914, a group of officers, they didn't exactly mutiny, because in order to mutiny, you need to disobey an order already given. But they signaled to their superiors that they would prefer to resign their commissions rather than be given an order to march on Ulster to enforce home rule. It didn't apply to every officer. The British government could still have found other officers without Irish connections who would have been willing to march on Ulster, but to enforce home rule. But it was simply the British government by then realised that it wasn't politically possible to do this. The British electorate, including many liberal supporters, would have revolted against any move to coerce people who, after all, people in Ulster who, after all, were guilty only of declaring loyalty to Britain, that to suppress them and force them to accept the authority of what seemed to them an alien parliament in Dublin, that would have looked to the British electorate like expelling part of the citizenry of the United Kingdom, a loyal citizenry, expelling them from the United Kingdom, from British citizenship and all the rights that went with that, and putting them under the rule of an alien nationalist government in Dublin. So the government realised it just simply couldn't do this.
So working towards a solution, you have the outbreak of war in Europe, and within a matter of days, Britain is committed to that war. I was wondering if you could speak here a bit about how Redmond responds, how the Irish nationalist movement responds to the outbreak of war, and how that, you know, and what his intentions are with that response at the beginning of the conflict.
Well, at the beginning of the conflict, the outbreak of the Great War actually saved Ireland from a local small war between Ulster volunteers and nationalist volunteers. Redmond had been preparing to go a little further than, significantly further than his original agreement, his original concession. He was preparing to to abandon the six-year time limit and to agree that those counties in Ulster which opted out of home rule could stay out as long as they liked. So this was going to be a form of indefinite partition. And he never got to make that speech because the Parliament had to turn its attention to much more pressing matters in Europe. And so the deadlock over partition remained. Then you had Britain went into the war with the Ulster question unresolved. And Redmond had to make some very, very quick decisions because Carson, the leader of the Ulster Unionists, had pledged immediately that his followers, the Ulster Volunteers, would be ready to serve the British cause anywhere in Europe. And Redmond had to match that with a similar declaration of loyalty from Nationalist Ireland in order to remain to remain in the good books of British public opinion. So he was caught in a very difficult situation. In August, the day before the outbreak of war, he stood up in the British Parliament and made an impromptu speech in which he pledged the loyalty and the sympathy of Nationalist Ireland to the British war effort. He didn't, at that point, pledge the recruiting efforts that he would later make for the British Army. In other words, he didn't commit the manpower of Nationalist Ireland to the British Army just yet. The reason was that although the Home Rule Act had been passed all stages in the House of Commons, it had not yet been signed into law by the King. It wasn't on the statute book. So for the first 6 weeks of the war, he had to lobby the British government, and it was a very difficult process because the unionists had already said we're agreeable to not discussing Home Rule. We want to concentrate on the war. But Redmond couldn't leave matters like that. He had to win the actual Home Rule Act onto the statute book before he could then tell Nationalist Ireland that it was okay to enlist in the British Army. So it was mid-September when he finally got the British government to agree that the King would sign the Act onto the statute book. This took place on the 18th of September. So the war was then 7 months old. One of the things that favoured Redmond in his earlier commitment to the British war effort was that Belgium was the first victim of the German advance into France. Germany had violated Belgian neutrality. That is an understatement because they had driven their armies right through Belgium and they had massacred hundreds of Belgian civilians along the way. Anybody even remotely suspected of carrying a weapon or interfering with the passage of German troops through the country was likely to be just put up against a wall and shot. Not only that, but the Germans burnt down some very important, they destroyed some towns in Belgium which had centuries-old associations with Irish Catholicism, the town of Louvain in particular, where there was an Irish university, or a university in which Irish Catholic refugees from the wars of the 17th century had studied. They burnt the town of Louvain along with a library containing thousands of precious manuscripts. It was something a little bit akin to what ISIS have been doing in Palmyra. The headline on some of the Irish nationalist newspapers, one I can think of in particular, an Irish national newspaper, the headline was War of the Barbarians. So Irish nationalist public opinion in the early months of the war was very pro-British, if only because it was very anti-German. And it was anti-German because it saw Belgium as a small fellow Catholic country raped by a large imperial aggressor. So Redmond did win. He had the wind behind him, if you like, in the early months on those grounds, on the grounds of public sympathy among his followers for Belgium.
But there's a there's an element in his judgment. There's an assumption, and that assumption is, and it's one that's shared by a lot of people at the very beginning, which is that this will be a short war.
Yeah, yeah. The initial assumption was the war would be over by Christmas. When that came and went, it was then assumed that it would be over within a year. I don't really think, though. I mean, it's often alleged, or it's often asserted, that the prolongation of the war in itself was the main factor that brought Redmond down in the end. I don't think it was. It certainly made things more difficult. But the real factor that that would destroy Redmond and ultimately Home Rule and the Home Rule Party was kind of hidden in when the war began, and it was the unresolved Ulster conflict. When the war began, Ulster simply went off the news pages. It wasn't forgotten about, but it simply ceased to be a big political issue, and it would have been at the back of the minds or the consciousness of Irish nationalists, but there was never a public outcry against temporary partition, the temporary scheme that Redmond had agreed to. It never built up enough momentum to cause a public outcry in 1914. So events moved forward in through 1915 and into early 1916. There was certainly a lot of unease in Nationalist Ireland about the future of Home Rule, especially when Prime Minister Asquith came under a lot of criticism for his management of the war. And in May 1915, he brought Tories into the government, to form a nationalist government. So Irish nationalists were then looking at some old enemies of Home Rule being now in the British government, and this made them very uneasy.
And I've got even a step further, because you describe in your book that there was an offer tendered to Redmond to join the government as a minister.
Yeah, Redmond was offered a place in the British government. He would have become some kind of a minister without portfolio or something like that. He turned it down. A mistake, in my view, although I can understand why he did it. And in fact, he probably was going to be damned if he did and damned if he didn't. He was... because it had been a long-standing ethic in Irish nationalist politics that you didn't take paid employment from the British government, and it was one of the chief weapons by which constitutional nationalists were able to maintain their credentials against the physical force or violent tradition, the Fenian tradition in nationalism, that they could maintain that they were incorruptible. If Redmond had taken a cabinet post, he, on the one hand, he would have had more influence with the British government. He might have been able to avert some of the mistakes. On the other hand, it would have given his enemies at home a field day to accuse him of, you know, being corrupt and accepting the Saxon shilling, as they would have put it, and so on. So he really didn't have too many good options. He didn't have any good options in that. But nevertheless, we shouldn't overplay the degree of negativity or unease among Redmond's nationalist followers. At the end of the day, there were 6 by-elections in the period, in the first 18 months of the war, which would bring us up to March 1916. During those 18 months, the Redmond's party, or if not Redmond's party, at least candidates pledged to Home Rule, won all 6 by-elections. Now, that wasn't a bad performance, considering the amount of discontent and unease. So the Home Rule party was still Home Rule was still the only game in town right up to the rebellion of Easter 1916. Easter 1916 came in late April, and that's when the rebellion, the one-week rebellion, which transformed everything, happened in Dublin. And it wasn't so much the rebellion was seen as a stab in the back for Redmond, which it was. It was as much a rebellion against the Home Rule Party as it was a rebellion against the British government. And most of that was horrified.
Yeah, I was going to say, was Redmond caught unaware by the rebellion? Because one of the things that I noticed as I was reading those chapters was he's very focused upon what's happening in London, and he has Dillon in Dublin. He has other, you know, people giving him information, but he seems to be not necessarily as attuned to what's happening within the currents of Irish politics in Ireland itself.
Yeah, there is Well, although he was, there was a division of labor between Redmond and Dillon. As you say, Dillon lived in Dublin. Redmond spent much more time at Westminster, and when he wasn't there, he was in his home in the remote Wicklow Mountains south of Dublin. But however, he wasn't out of touch with Irish opinion. His correspondence with his follower with his MPs was still as full as ever, and he was still attuned to what was happening. But I think this is a collective thing affecting the Irish leadership as a whole, and not only the Irish leadership, but the chief secretary, Augustine Birrell, who was the man who had been given the job of paving the way for Home Rule as far back as 1907. In retrospect, they all seemed to be like rabbits caught in headlights. They had warnings. They had warnings from people that the rebellious faction within the volunteers. It must be said that when the Irish volunteers had split in 1914 over Redmond's encouragement of enlisting in the British Army, but the faction who opposed Redmond amounted to 7% of the membership of the volunteers. So, in the intervening 18 months up to 1916, those 7% had increased their activity, and they were being manipulated behind the scenes by this tiny elite of the seven-member military council of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which had decided on an armed rebellion against the British rule as soon as they could. So they were planning for that. The membership of the Irish Volunteers, although they were dissident and opposed being enlisted into the British Army, most of the membership, the rank and file membership, didn't know that a rebellion was actually being planned. So they were being manipulated and maneuvered into a rebellion. The rebellion finally broke out in Easter Week, 1916. But Redmond and his colleagues all collectively assumed that the rebellion would be something on the, you know, would be a minor affair, that there might be a skirmish or a riot or two, and there might be a little bit of violence. They didn't envisage anything on the scale of what actually happened. It's one of these, when I think of this, I think of 9/11. I think of how, you know, you can, in retrospect, you can point backwards and say, you know, there were many warnings. Why wasn't the FBI more galvanized for a threat and so on? It's just one of these things that people fight issues along in the light of previous experience. They don't anticipate a new and very different a turn of events. So
plus you mentioned that they had been receiving warnings as early as September of 1914.
Yeah.
So in the roughly 18, 19 months leading up to the rebellion, there'd always been this undercurrent, this concern, but there's a difference between, you know, rumors and the reality of rebellion that shocks many people.
Yeah, that's right. They could dismiss them as rumors. Redmond, being a consummate Democrat and a parliamentarian, he tended to see things in terms of majorities and minorities. And he thought, okay, there is a minority planning something, planning trouble. But they will, because nationalists, the majority of Irish nationalists are out of sympathy with that approach, and they will overbear the minority. He didn't think in terms of a highly motivated minority who are capable of setting a whole new agenda. Yeah, as 9/11 proves to us, and many other similar events, the minority doesn't need, you know, a minority, and in fact, by the very fact of its being a minority, can actually do more to set a new agenda than without looking for majority support. They can turn the majority, they can force the majority to accept a whole new reality. And that's what happened. I mean, in Easter Week 1916, the seat of British rule in Dublin, Dublin Castle, was guarded by six British soldiers. That's the number of armed soldiers that were guarding the seat of British administration in Dublin. Six soldiers. The rest of them on that day were at the races at a place 14 miles outside Dublin, an annual racing event, horse racing. So that's how complacent the British authorities were, in spite of the warnings that they'd been given.
How did the rebellion change Redmond's position in Irish politics? And how did he respond to this new world that had been created by the Rising?
Well, the big event that followed the rebellion itself was, of course, the executions of 14 of the leaders within the 2 weeks after the surrender of the rebels. And then later on, at the end of the summer, there was a 15th execution of Sir Roger Casement. And those 15 executions transformed emotional sentiment within the Irish nationalist community, even though the vast majority of nationalists were horrified by the rebellion. Even in retrospect, they gave it no support. But within a month, sympathy had begun to shift to the rebels, even if not retrospective support for the project itself. There was a sympathy that Irish men had been gunned down by British troops in Dublin, and this was a very emotive affair. And
Redmond had actually wrote to counsel against those executions.
Yeah. In the very early stage, he had more or less agreed in private that the ringleaders must be dealt with the utmost severity. But in his mind, he thought of one or two or three at the most. But when the executions began to go on over a week and then into a second week, he began to lobby the British government to have them stopped, because he could see, and he was getting reports from Irish America that they were having a very negative effect in the States, in the United States. So he pleaded with Asquith to have them stopped. Unfortunately, Asquith had appointed a British Army general and given him more or less carte blanche to deal with the rebellion. And General Maxwell was by this time in Dublin and more or less running matters himself. Now, Asquith did have the execution stopped after the second week, but by then much of the damage had been done. And martial law was actually declared by General Maxwell, although it was never put into effect. This is sometimes a misconceived impression. Martial law was never actually put into action, but the British reckoned that they had enough previous legislation to deal with the aftermath of the rebellion. But nevertheless, there were many arrests around the country in places which had been stayed peaceful. The rebellion, it must be remembered, was only took place in Dublin, and there were the beginnings of rebellion in a couple of other towns. But by and large, nationalist Ireland had remained quiet. But now the police and the army were raiding for arms and weaponry in other peaceful parts of Ireland, and this antagonized the population, and the arrests of people who against whom there was no evidence, that also antagonized the population. So Redmond, for the rest of that summer, Redmond was fighting a rearguard action. There's a very large, thick file of correspondence between Redmond and General Maxwell, in which Redmond is lobbying on behalf of people who have approached him to plead their innocence, and to families of people who've been arrested, to have them released. And Redmond was successful to quite a large extent, but nevertheless, it took many months before the innocent were released. And in the meantime, opinion had been alienated and antagonized. So coming the immediate political event that presented a very serious crisis for Redmond, and which ultimately began his destruction, was an event that happened beginning 2 months after the rebellion. And this is we're talking about June and July of 1916. The British government was looking around for what to do, for something to do about the Irish situation. It seemed clear to everybody that Dublin Castle rule, the administration as it had been, was now a busted flush, that there was no future. And an attempt began to conciliate nationalist Ireland. And the means to do this was to put the Home Rule Bill, the Home Rule Act, I should say, which had been on the statute book since September 1914, to actually put this into immediate operation. It had been suspended until the end of the war, but now the British, and this wasn't just liberals, but even Tories, who had been quite prominent in campaigning against Home Rule, now thought that in order to placate American opinion, that the Home Rule Act should now be put into operation. It must be remembered that at this time, with the war going very badly for the Allies, the British government, Lloyd George was now Lloyd George didn't become Prime Minister until the end of 1916, but the British government was looking to America to enter the war. And Irish-American and German-American opinion was very much opposed to any thought of America entering the war. And Woodrow Wilson had been re-elected on a platform of keeping America out of the war. So there was an uphill battle to be climbed in terms of for the British in terms of winning U.S. entry into the war. Therefore, British politicians of all parties decided that to placate American opinion, Ireland should be given home rule immediately. So Lloyd George began a process. Lloyd George was now Minister of Munitions, a very, very powerful minister in the British government. He agreed to carry on shuttle negotiations between Redmond and Carson. And he stitched a deal together which they could both agree to on a provisional basis. And the deal was that the Home Rule Bill, the Home Rule Act of Parliament should now come into immediate operation, but the six northeastern counties should be excluded. And this arrangement would continue for the rest of the war and for 1 year thereafter. And after that, it would continue until the British Parliament came to make another arrangement. Now, both sides could accept this. Redmond accepted it because he saw it was presented to him as a strictly provisional. Provisional meant a little more than temporary, but nevertheless, it wasn't final. For Carson, the fact that only Parliament could change it at the very end of the process meant that he felt pretty secure that partition wouldn't be undone at the end of the provisional period. So both sides were able to just about sell this to their followers within Ireland. What happened, it looked as if the deal was going to be okay and that the British government would then enact legislation at the end of July. But the opposition to the deal came from an unforeseen quarter. It came from prominent Southern unionists. When I say Southern, I mean Southern Ireland unionists. These were large landowners who still had quite extensive holdings in the south of Ireland, but had been anti-partition. They had wanted all of Ireland, the entire island of Ireland, to remain within the United Kingdom. But they had, in the early part of the war, they had just about been reconciling themselves to home rule. As long as the home rule government maintained a certain loyalty of sympathy to Britain, but now, in the aftermath of the rebellion, they saw home rule as a reward for terrorism or a reward for violence. And their leader, Lord Lansdowne, in the British Parliament, he set out to wreck the deal. So the deal had been more or less agreed between the leaders of the two communities in Ireland. But this unforeseen actor, Lord Lansdowne, head of the Southern Unionists, wrecked the deal. And the way he did it was he persuaded the British government that in the parliamentary language of the legislation, that the word permanent should be put in to describe partition, that a partition should be formally made permanent. Now, Redmond had based his entire support for the deal on the provisionality, he had sold it on the basis of partition being maybe an indefinite future possibility, but by no means solidly entrenched in the here and now. It was all a very delicate matter of language and semantics, and the British government don't seem to have seen what really the problem was. And misunderstandings of language between British and Irish leaders had been a leading source of the conflict for many, many generations. And this was no exception. The British didn't really see what the problem was. Redmond had, after all, said that he was against the coercion of any Ulster county to join Home Rule. So what was the problem then in calling exclusion or partition permanent? Well, it meant an awful lot symbolically to Redmond and to nationalists, because he had to hold out at least the theoretical possibility of reunion of the whole island at some point in the future. And making partition permanent looked like applying a surgical scalpel to the map of Ireland and dividing it forever. So this was something he had to reject. Therefore, he had to pull out of the deal. And when he pulled out of the deal, he had to come back to his followers tainted with the fact that he had agreed to partition, and yet he had nothing to show for it. In the meantime, new political forces were on the rise, who were capitalizing on the big wave of Anglophobia which was sweeping across the country after the executions. And
he lived another 18 months, and the last couple of chapters, he seems to have one misfortune piling upon another: the death of his brother, the growing strength of Sinn Féin, the loss of all the growing number of losses in by-elections. It really seems to have just worn him down.
Yeah, it did. It wore him down. But at he was worn down politically, as you say, by personal bereavement. His eldest daughter had emigrated to New York and was living there, was married to an Irish doctor living in New York, and she died at the age of 33. That was a huge personal blow. His brother, Willie, one of the oldest men serving with the British forces on the Western Front, the age of 56, Willie had donned a British Army uniform in order to encourage his followers to enlist. And he was living in a trench in the Western Front. He was killed in June 1917. These were huge personal blows to Redmond. But aside from that, if we go back to the failure of the summer 1916 Home Rule deal, which Redmond had to pull out of, from that point, there dates a political paralysis of Redmond's party, because he can't go back and he can't go forward. From that point on, he forswears all further negotiation with the British government about any form of partition. He cannot, it's politically impossible to accept any form of partition. The point is that I said earlier that in 1914, the partition issue had never reached the level of causing a public outcry. But in late 1916, it did just that. It became a toxic political issue. The entire nationalist population became sensitized to partition as never before. And it became politically impossible for any nationalist politician to even entertain the concept of it, never mind agree to it. So Redmond could not enter any new negotiations on the same basis as he had. The moment had passed in July 1916 at which he might have pulled off a Home Rule deal and just about won the support of Nationalist Ireland on the basis of partition. It simply wasn't practical politics after that. So he goes into 1917 then with this paralysis. He can't go back to any negotiations. But meanwhile, the Sinn Féin party is now reorganizing itself, capitalizing on the emotions of especially the young people who had never yet voted, but were going to be given the franchise in the election of 1918. These people are swinging over these are becoming the new electorate and overwhelmingly Home Rule in sympathy. Meanwhile, the older electorate who had supported the Irish party can see very little future for Home Rule politics, because Lloyd George, who's now Prime Minister in 1917, is offering Redmond Home Rule. But what he's offering is Home Rule with partition. He's saying the nationalist parts of Ireland can have all the self-government that you have in the Home Rule Act. We'll even improve on the financial terms of 1914, because war taxes had radically changed the finances of the Act. So Lloyd George is offering to make the financial terms of the Act much more favourable. But Nationalist Ireland is simply saying we cannot accept this. So a Nationalist Ireland is then redefining home rule. It's saying it's accusing the British of withholding home rule, even though the British are saying we will give you home rule. The reason is that Nationalist Ireland is saying that home rule without the six counties of Northern Ireland is simply not home rule. We reject it. And so this was the paralysed condition in which Redmond found himself politically throughout 1917. There was a last-ditch effort in the form of the Irish Convention, which he attended. This was the last attempt to get to win support among all communities within Ireland, within all political forces on the island, to win an all-Ireland self-government. But it never really, it was always running the risk of being sidelined by Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin was capitalising on the legacy of the rebels of Easter 1916, even though Sinn Féin itself had not taken part in the rebellion. The people, the Éamon de Valera, the only surviving rebel commandant, the one who hadn't been executed because of his American citizenship, he'd been born in New York. De Valera was now at the head of Sinn Féin by late 1917, and he was winning landslide victories in by-elections, and the Irish Party was increasingly demoralised and increasingly paralysed politically. And so in March 1918, then Redmond had been suffering increasing ill health from 1916 onwards, and in March 1918, he died. And very soon after his death, just about all of the projects which had engaged his energies, the 16th Irish Division, which was made up of the nationalists whom he had recruited for the British Army, that was decimated by German advance, the German breakthrough on at the Somme, March 1918. The Irish Convention collapsed or failed to reach agreement shortly after he died. And later that year, in the December general election of the general election of December 1918, Sinn Féin won a landslide victory and practically wiped out the Irish Parliamentary Party. So all three of Redmond's political projects were died more or less with him or shortly after him.
I love the way you put it in the penultimate chapter. Rarely is the life's work of a public person so comprehensively erased by history.
Yeah, it's just incredible. I haven't come across anybody else. I mean, you know, it's a commonplace to say that that all political careers end in failure. It's a truism, and it may not always be true, but it's true of many politicians. But in Redmond's case, it really reaches an extreme level. That you have not just the man himself failing in his immediate projects, but just about everything that he had spent his 37-year career campaigning for, dies with him. Now, as against that, of course, we could say that the reforms, the social reforms which his party had brought in during those 10 years, the first decade of the 20th century, when he was waiting for his political opportunity to bring home rule into life, to bring that issue to life. Those social reforms, the land purchase scheme, the housing for rural labourers, the university, housing for the working classes in the cities, those reforms were... They constitute a lasting legacy. It's one that's completely forgotten in contemporary Ireland. Nobody remembers these at all. Redmond is remembered in contemporary nationalist Ireland as a failed leader. And the controversy revolves around whether he should or shouldn't have bargained with the British. He's seen by some as weak for agreeing to encourage nationalists to enlist in the British Army before Home Rule was actually put into practice. So that's that. You know, these controversies revolve around Redmond. There are public monuments in Dublin City to Charles Stewart Parnell and to Daniel O'Connell. There is absolutely no public monument to Redmond. He was unlucky in the fact that the other two guys had succeeding parliamentary leaders to build monuments to them. It was Parnell who formally opened the monument to Daniel O'Connell, and it was Redmond who formally unveiled the monument to Parnell in 1911. But there was nobody left of the constitutional strand of nationalism to unveil a monument to Redmond after he died. And the people who took power in the new independent state were people who had been hostile to Redmond all through his career, the inheritors of the Sinn Féin. You might say that beyond the grave, Redmond probably did enjoy a final bitter, final last laugh, if you like, that he had been brought down in the final by-elections where the Irish Party lost to Sinn Féin. The principal issue was partition. Sinn Féin were castigating him for agreeing to partition. But as it would turn out later, after 2,000 deaths in the War of Independence against the British, the final treaty left Northern Ireland as part of the United Kingdom. So partition happened anyway. So although Sinn Féin had used it to bring the Irish Party down, they themselves proved to be no more successful than Redmond had been in averting partition. And we still have
2,000 lives later, it's the same outcome that Redmond was on the cusp of achieving himself.
Exactly. Yeah. So we could now the one thing that Sinn Féin can legitimately claim that they won, that Redmond didn't win, was that they won a greater degree of autonomy. The essential nature of the treaty that emerged from after the War of Independence in 1921 was what could be called Canadian-style home rule. It was called then Dominion Home Rule. It gave a wider powers than the original Home Rule Act would have given. In other words, the country was free to have a standing army and to have a diplomatic service, a foreign office, and so on. But nevertheless, the king or the monarch of Great Britain would be the head of state of the new Irish Free State. So those are the pluses and minuses of what Redmond achieved and didn't achieve.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I'm working now I'm looking at the details of how public opinion in nationalist Ireland changed in the wake of the rebellion. So I'm looking at essentially what I've just been talking about there, the movements of opinion within nationalism from summer of 1916, from the failure of the Home Rule deal, the rise of Sinn Féin, how the various organs of opinion like newspapers, the only media then really newspapers, and also some of the private correspondence between the Home Rule leaders and the British government politicians. I'm looking at how exactly the original Home Rule project died and the new politics took over.
Sounds like a very interesting project.
It begins with 1916, ends in 1919.
So that 3-year time period in which so much changes.
Exactly, so much changed, yeah.
Well, Dermot, thank you for being on the show. It was great hearing about the life of John Redmond, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
It was a great pleasure, Mark, to talk to you, and a great honor to be interviewed. So I wish you the best, and your listeners. Thank you.